briefly euphoric, almost dizzy. But the feeling was short-lived. She'd gotten her mom only temporarily off her back. If her dad insisted on driving straight to April's house, if he discovered she wasn't there. But if everything went as planned, she could make it to April's by morning, when her dad was still 30,000 feet over the Atlantic. If everything went as planned, she might have all the answers she needed tonight. And then what? What did it matter, really? She wasn't sure. But she sensed, no, she knew, that there was in Haven a reason for her dad's constant simmering anger, for the pills her mom measured out day by day, for the vast silence that filled her house and the way she caught her parents looking at her sometimes as if she were a stranger. She had to know why. Her phone pinged. She assumed it would be her mom calling back, but saw she had a new message from Pete, a gif of a cartoon cowboy wrangling an alligator. She tried watching TV, but couldn't get anything but a blinking error message. She was nervous about what they were about to attempt, which was more dangerous than anything she'd ever even considered. She'd once nearly crapped herself cutting gym class to hang out with April like badasses behind the tennis courts. She wished she were the kind of girl who, when nervous, lost her appetite. Instead, she made 4 trips to the vending machine, which contained only a few warm sodas, some Kit Kats, cardboard-tasting chips, and a bag of ancient Sour Patch Kids, shriveled and dry as discarded husks of molted cicadas. She searched for more news about what had happened at Haven, refreshing the few local news sites that were covering it, and toggling back and forth between individual blogs and conspiracy sites. The explosion had renewed public interest in Haven. She found a couple of news sites that referenced the controversy from several years ago, in which Haven was listed as one of the research institutes that had illegally purchased human tissue for research, including embryonic and stem cells. She knew embryonic cells were used for medical research. It fit Jake's theory. Fine and Ives had even released a statement, a bland PR document about a sudden fire at one of their research institutes. Every article had attracted dozens of comments, many of them nonsensical or filled with curses and hysterical references to escaped biological agents. Around 9, she saw references on several sites to a terrorist attack, by an individual who supposedly believed she was acting on God's commandment and had somehow managed to infiltrate the island. But there was frustratingly little information about the attack, and after only 20 minutes, many of the individual's story links had been disabled or taken down. She was halfway through an article about the possibility that the person responsible had managed to stow away on the ferry that collected the waste from Haven twice a week, when the whole page just blinked and then went dark, as if someone had pulled a curtain over her screen. She reloaded the page several times, but kept getting the same 404 error. "What the hell?" She jabbed her screen with a finger, trying to figure out how a web page could just disappear while she was looking at it. There was a knock at the door, and she jumped. She'd lost track of time completely. It was 11 o'clock already. Jake had changed into a black t-shirt, dark jeans, and black Vans. When Gemma opened the door, she thought he looked like the lead singer in some indie band April might have been obsessed with. She wished temporarily she'd done something with her hair. More delusion. As if a great hairstyle would distract him from the 30 extra pounds she was packing. He came into the room without saying hello and sat down on the bed. "Did you hear?" he said. When he shoved a hand through his hair, it resettled right away. Soft, then. Of course. The cops traced the explosion. She closed the door and leaned against it. It occurred to her that this was exactly what she'd sworn to April she wouldn't do, meet a stranger in a seedy motel room. Maybe she'd sit down next to him and he'd try and touch her thigh or force his tongue down her throat. Then again, she wouldn't mind. If anyone was in danger of getting sexually harassed, it was probably him. Jake pulled out a laptop from his backpack. This came into my inbox an hour ago. He pivoted his computer screen around. When my dad died, I couldn't bring myself to shut down the Haven Files admin on his website, so messages get routed to my inbox. She joined him on the bed, moving stiffly, hoping he wouldn't notice. She could smell his soap, and when he shifted the laptop onto her lap, his fingers grazed her thigh. It was the first time a guy had ever touched her, and even though it was accidental, she got a small thrill. The message had apparently come through the contact form on his website. It was addressed not to Jake, but to the administrator. It was written in all caps. When Jesus died, the curtain in the temple was torn into two pieces. The graves opened, and many of God's people who had died were raised from death. Matthew chapter 27, verse 51 through 53. God turns his face from abominations and casts monsters down to hell, and those who disobey his word will feel the wrath of eternity. At Haven, dead men walk from their graves, and God demands justice for the crimes of those who don't listen. I will bring hellfire to Haven like God did to the sinners at Babylon to purge them from this earth, and I will be welcomed by all the angels in heaven who will sing my praises. The message was signed Angel Fire and included a link to a Tumblr, www.wrathofgod.tumblr.com, but when Gemma tried to click on it, she found it disabled. Jake took the computer back from her. The site was registered to an Estelle Williams in Sarasota. They already wiped it clean. But I managed to get screenshots, though. Give me a second. Gemma thought of all the pages she'd Googled, turning up suddenly wiped or just failing to load. Who's they? He shifted on the bed, and Gemma realized he was nervous. One of the federal departments, I assume, Jake said, looking at her sideways, as if expecting she wouldn't believe him. I wouldn't be surprised if by tomorrow everyone's reporting that Haven never existed at all. It was some holographic experiment, and we're all supposed to forget about it. Look. He swiveled the screen toward her again. This is some of Angel Fire stuff. Gemma keystroked through a few pages, most of them decorated with grinning skulls or licks of flame, and peppered with biblical verse and lots of exclamation points. She thinks they're raising people from the dead at Haven? She asked. She thought that, he said quietly. If she really is responsible for what happened, if she did turn herself into one gigantic IED, like they're saying, she's scattered across the marshes by now. He shook his head, and Gemma couldn't help but think. Another person dead. Another person dead because of Haven. Nurse M, Jake's father. And now this woman, Angel Fire. She must have timed her message to go out to a bunch of people at once. Even the news channels got wind of it, and they're always the last to know anything. He closed the laptop and slipped it into his backpack, which was, predictably, black, and stood up. So, are you ready? I guess so. She knew it was stupid to be freaked out by some nutter's theory about Haven and its weird science. But she couldn't shake the image of people staggering through the darkness of the marshes, reaching for her with clammy hands. You need to be sure, sure. Jake stood up. We might get arrested. Suddenly, though, Gemma felt as if all those Sour Patch Kids were nails trying to claw back out of her throat. She had the sense that being arrested would be the best thing that might happen to them. Jake had told her that several weeks after his father died, he'd woken up in the middle of the night, certain that someone had just shaken him awake. But he was in the room alone. Still, every few minutes he felt a phantom pressure on his shoulder, as though someone was tapping him. I know what you're probably thinking, he'd said, a little too forcefully. But I don't believe in things like that. Spirits, voices from the grave. I'm not like my dad. Still, the impression of a presence wouldn't leave him. Every few minutes, there was a tap-tap on his shoulder. So, he had stood up, walked down the stairs, and walked straight out of the house. His mom had just returned from Las Vegas, where she'd been living doing God knows what, essentially refusing to recognize the existence of her son except in the occasional birthday message, usually an email sent a few days late. Within a month, she would be gone again, and Jake would move in with his dad's sister, a widow who'd never had children and never wanted any. Guided by a certainty he could never afterward explain, he had walked the 5 miles to the Wali Basin campsite, where he and his father had set off so many times together, and found a rowboat pitted with rust, likely left there by a local fisherman. The whole time, he said, he could feel an occasional tap on his shoulder, like a kind of Morse code telling him to go on. He had no compass, no water, no supplies, and yet somehow that night, alone in the marshes, he knew exactly where to go. Dawn was breaking by the time he saw a bank of spruce and knew he'd reached Spruce Island. The Institute was hidden from view. He realized he must have rowed all the way around to the west side of the island, which was still undeveloped. The security was lighter, too. There was a fence and guard towers, but at dawn they were abandoned. And still the finger kept tap-tap-tapping on his shoulder. He pulled his boat up onto shore, less than 10 feet away from a downed tree that had taken down a 4-foot section of the fence. He was on the island less than 10 minutes before he was caught, thrown to the ground by military-style guards, frog-marched across the island and out to the dock, where police were already waiting for him. He never went near the main buildings, had only the briefest glimpse of the white-walled institute and the people inside it. But it was enough. She looked around the room, wishing she didn't have the melodramatic feeling she was seeing it for the last time. Even though it had been her idea to try and get to Haven tonight. Or maybe because it had been. She felt she couldn't back out now. "I'm sure," she said, grabbing the only sweatshirt she'd brought. She wished it weren't bright pink. Jake was obviously thinking the same thing because he frowned. "Take this." He wrestled a black windbreaker out of his backpack. It was a warm night, but the mosquitoes on the marshes, he told her, were killer. Jake's car was so old it seemed predominantly composed of duct tape and string. "Sorry," he said, with an apologetic smile that made Gemma's heart purr. "But at least you're getting door-to-door service." The car rattled so hard when he accelerated, she was sure she was about to be expelled from her seat, that the car would just roll over and give up, panting, like a tired dog. But she didn't want to complain, and sat there white-knuckling her seat so hard her fingers ached. "Just a few more miles," Jake said. They'd looped around to approach Wali from the north, on one of the few roads that gave access to the nature reserve, and the bouncing of the headlights made Gemma feel seasick. Miraculously, they made it without incident, although Gemma could have sworn that the car gave a relieved sigh when Jake cut the engine. Stepping outside, she was immediately overwhelmed by the sound of the tree frogs. They were so loud and so uniform, they seemed like a single entity, like the heartbeat of the world rising and falling. Even here, she thought she detected a faint smell of smoke. Jake removed a flashlight from his backpack and gestured for Gemma to follow him. The Wali Nature Reserve was technically closed at sunset, and theirs was the only car. They moved onto one of the paths that cut into a thicket of pine and mangrove trees, and immediately Gemma felt a difference in the ground, a sponginess that made her heart turn over a little. Jake had told her casually that all the islands and marshes around here would be gone in 20 years, swallowed up by water. She imagined the trees submerged, stretching ghostly fingers up toward a sun filtered through layers of murky water. She wondered what April would think now If she knew that Gemma was following a boy she didn't know into a darkened nature reserve with no one around for miles. She didn't know anymore whether she was glad or worried that she hadn't told anyone where she was going. They walked for 15 minutes, though it felt like longer, and the sticky, humid air seemed to get all tangled up in Gemma's lungs. After a certain point, they didn't seem to be following a path at all, and she had no idea how Jake was sure that he was heading in the right direction. The marshes had tides that shifted subtly and without sound. The water wouldn't even warn them before appearing suddenly beneath their feet. Jake stopped and touched her elbow.
"We're close," he said. "Go carefully. There are tidal pools here."
"Okay," Gemma said. Her voice sounded strange in the humid darkness, like it was being muffled by a pillow. She was sorry when Jake took his hand away. A few paces farther on, Jake stopped completely and angled his flashlight at a patch of ghostly white sawgrass running down to a black expanse she now recognized as an inlet. Partially concealed beneath a myrtle oak was a bright red kayak, which he'd rented from a local boat shop and stashed earlier that night. It was skinny and long as a popsicle. Gemma's stomach dropped.
"I don't think we're both going to fit," Gemma said desperately, as Jake bent over to drag the kayak free of the growth.
"Of course we will. It's a 2-seater. He pointed with the flashlight.
There were, in fact, 2 seats in the kayak, if you could call them seats. Gemma thought they looked like those car seats meant for toddlers.
"I'm not going to fit," Gemma wanted to say, but of course she couldn't. Not to him. Jake was the kind of guy who had size 0 girlfriends who modeled locally and were always complaining about trying to find clothes small enough.
"Can't we get another boat?" she asked desperately. "A boat?"
He must have thought she was kidding because he only laughed.
"Anything bigger, we'll just get stuck. Some of the channels out there are so narrow, even the kayak's a stretch."
Jake bent down and shoved the kayak down into the water, which sucked at the plastic with a wet farting sound. He steadied it with a foot.
"Besides, it's more comfortable than it looks."
He clambered easily into the kayak, or the floating popsicle, and somehow enfolded his long legs inside it, as if he were just sitting down in a chair. Then he maneuvered the kayak so he could reach out a hand to help Gemma inside.
"Come on," he said. "You'll be fine."
She bit her lip. She had a sudden vision of getting stuck in her seat, of having to be hauled out of the kayak by a crane, or worse, of not being able to fit inside in the first place. But she took his hand. As soon as she placed a foot into the kayak, it began bucking like a badly trained horse, and if the boat hadn't still been rooted in the mud of the bank, she was sure the whole thing would have gone over.
"All right, now the other foot. There you go. Easy now."
Somehow she managed to climb in without flipping the kayak, and even more miraculously managed to squeeze herself down into the hard plastic seat, feeling a little like an elephant in a girdle.
"See?"
Jake used a plastic paddle to push them out of the mud and turn them in the right direction. He was smiling at her again, his teeth white in the moonlight.
"Not so bad, is it?"
"For the record," Gemma blurted out, "this is exactly as comfortable as it looks."
"Aw, come on, don't be a baby."
But he was still smiling. And as they began to move through the marshes, her spirits lifted. Jake had given her a paddle, but instructed her not to use it, and she was happy to let him do the work. They progressed steadily and in near silence, except for the slurping of the water on the paddles. They'd agreed in advance that they should try and avoid talking as much as possible, in case there were patrols on the marshes. So far, it seemed their gamble, that after what had happened, security would be trying to get everyone out, not worrying about people trying to get in, was correct. Occasionally, helicopters passed in the distance on their way to and from the island, but less frequently now, and Gemma knew they must still be ferrying people from the island. It was unlikely, however, that given Haven's security,
any survivors had even made it onto the marshes, which explained why they were putting hardly any effort into searching for them. After an hour, they'd met no one, heard no one, although occasionally they seemed to hear shouting in the distance, and Gemma knew they were still quite far from Haven. The marshes really did look like a labyrinth, full of narrow channels that forced them back toward the mainland before they could find another vein of water to follow in the right direction. Every few minutes, Jake stopped to consult the compass on his phone. With the sawgrass growing as high as a tall man, and mangrove trees furry with overhanging moss, they would have otherwise had no way of knowing where the mainland was and which way led to open ocean. But there was a strange beauty to the marshes, and the tangles of dark weeds that drifted just below the surface of the water and came up on Jake's paddle, like long, dark fingers drawing him back, and the sawgrass painted white with bird guano. The moon was full and bright, even behind a wispy covering of smoke, and so close Gemma could see individual craters, a pattern of trenches and shadow that made a grinning face. Jake picked out constellations to show her, and Gemma thought they all looked like they were winking down at her, letting her in on some secret. Jake obviously loved the marshes, despite what had happened to his dad here, and he told her stories of camping trips and frog-hunting expeditions, how his dad had renamed all the stars he didn't know, and claimed Orion's Belt had been named for a drunk god who liked to pee in the Wali. Jake shook his head. "I believed him for so many years," he smiled. "Whenever I see Orion's Belt, I think of him." It occurred to Gemma that this was the second time in the past 24 hours she'd been squeezed next to a cute boy in a strange vehicle. Maybe tomorrow she would meet a tall, dark, handsome stranger who'd want to take her on a motorcycle ride. Maybe she'd end up in Vegas working for the mob as a professional blackjack dealer. At that moment, anything at all seemed possible. She lost track of time completely, but knew they must be getting closer. Sometimes she thought she heard the echo of overlapping voices, and once Jake froze, sticking the paddle down into the mud and shoving them into the shadow of an overhanging sand oak. But the voices always receded. If there were other people out in the darkness, the marshes were expansive enough to keep them at a distance. At one point, Jake fished out his phone to check the time, and Gemma saw that he looked exhausted. She felt horrible. She hadn't been helping at all, and he'd been paddling for nearly 2 hours.
1 a.m., he said.
He was a little out of breath.
"We must be getting close."
"You need a break," Gemma said.
"I'm okay,"
Jake said, completely unconvincingly. "You're a terrible liar," Gemma said firmly. "You need a break." She, too, needed to stretch. Her feet had gone numb hours ago. He didn't argue again. He angled the kayak up into the shallows and freed himself, so tired he didn't even complain when he sank a leg shin-deep in the mud. He helped shove the kayak onto sturdier ground so she could disembark. A rush of sudden feeling invaded her legs, and she nearly stumbled. Jake caught her, and for a second, she was close to him, his hands on her elbow, his lips bow-shaped, and his jaw just stubbled with hair, and his eyes unreadable in the dark. She quickly pulled away. She helped him haul the kayak farther into the grass so it wouldn't drift away. The sawgrass grew nearly to shoulder height, and Gemma was glad, now, for the windbreaker. It was sharp and left sores on her exposed skin. As they hacked through the grass, for the first time in hours, she spotted Spruce Island. By this point, so close she could make out individual trees and the spiky points of the guard towers which looked to be abandoned. They had somehow come around the westernmost tip of the island, which was densely overgrown. She could make out none of the buildings, although some lingering smoke indicated a point in the distance where they must have been. Gemma was so tired she'd forgotten to be nervous. Now, however, she remembered.
"What now?" she whispered. "Do you think we can still get..."
She broke off before she said, "Closer." Jake went very still. They'd both heard it. A muffled cry. Jake grabbed her arm and pulled her into a crouch. He brought a finger to his lips, but there was no need. Gemma was so frightened she couldn't have made a sound if she wanted to. The silence was anything but reassuring. They'd heard a voice, a human voice, 10, 20 feet away in the marshes, which meant that whoever had cried out was now deliberately being quiet, creeping up on them maybe, waiting to attack. Gemma pictured herself handcuffed in a military facility, a single light bulb swinging overhead, an ugly army sergeant with a face like an old baseball mitt leaning forward to spit on her. She was scared of Chloe DeWitt, 90-pound blonde shrimpoid. She would never make it in prison. Then again, maybe she'd just get shot in the back, hit by a sniper from a distance of 100 yards. One breath in, and one breath out, and then darkness forever. Then they heard it. A faint rustling of the grass, followed by a sharp silence, as if someone had taken a step and then frozen. Jake was so still she couldn't even tell if he was breathing. The footstep had come from somewhere behind them. Jake gestured in the opposite direction. "Move," he mouthed, and despite the fact that Jem's legs felt stiff and fatter than usual, she began to inch forward, shuffling crab-like as quietly as possible. Her thighs were burning, and tears sprang up unexpectedly in her eyes. Pathetic. Out here on the marshes in the middle of the night, crying because no one knew where she was, because she hadn't told her mom she loved her, because she hadn't told April either, because her thighs were really out of shape, and she would never wear a bathing suit again. They would kill her. They would shoot first and make it look like an accident.
"Who's there?"
The voice was harsh, male, and came from no more than 10 feet behind her. Jem forgot to stay down, forgot to stay quiet, forgot to keep hidden. Something screamed through her chest and into her head, an ancient voice shouting, "Go!" A force exploding into her muscles and lifting her to her feet. She was running. She was plunging blindly through the sawgrass and the salt-eaten shrubs, ignoring the cuts on her shins and forearms. There were shouts now, from all around her, or so it seemed. She didn't stop, wasn't thinking, couldn't hear anything but that drumbeat of panic. Her foot snagged, and her ankle went out. She stumbled on something buried in the grass, and for a second that seemed like an eternity, she was in the air falling, still imagining hands to reach out and grab her. She landed so hard the wind went out of her, and she curled in on herself, shocked and airless, fighting for a breath that wouldn't come. Then Jake was next to her again, pulling her up so she was sitting. She finally took a breath, a long gasp of it, and began coughing. "Jesus," he whispered. He was sweating. He looked like he was going to be sick. "Jesus Christ."
"That voice," she managed to say. "Where did it come from? Where are they?"
"I don't know," he said. "Christ, Gemma. Look."
She turned to see what had tripped her. Time that had moved so slowly seemed to crack entirely. For a long second, she didn't understand what she was seeing. And then she thought, wished, hoped. It was an animal, some kind of strange, underwater, speckled thing. But then Jake drew back and began to cough, half-choking, and dropped his flashlight. Gemma saw in its beam the dimpled elbow, the fingers curled in a half-fist, and a green medical bracelet strapped around the bony wrist. She couldn't have said, then or afterward, what made her reach out to part the grasses with a hand so that she could better see the girl's face. Instinct, maybe. Or shock. She was thinner than Gemma. Much thinner. Her scalp was shaved, but in places a fuzz of brown hair had begun to regrow. Her green eyes were open to the sky, and her mouth was open too, as if in a silent scream. There were four freckles on the bridge of her nose. Four freckles Gemma knew because she counted them every day in the mirror, because Chloe DeWitt had once taken a pen and connected them during nap time in kindergarten. The soft, plump mouth that had been her grandmother's. The hard, angular jaw that belonged to her dad. Behind her, Jake was still gasping.
What the hell? What the hell?
The girl, the dead girl, was wearing Gemma's face. Gemma. Chapter 9. Gemma sometimes had nightmares where she was trapped in a crowd in an underground vault. In her dream, she was usually looking for someone, often her parents, sometimes April, or even Rufus. But everywhere she turned, she saw reflections of herself, not in mirrors, but in the distorted faces of the people looking back at her. All of these not Gemmas, laughing the more frantic she became. She always woke up shaken and sick. This was like that, only worse. She had the impression of swinging over a pit, as if the world might simply buck her into nothingness, and she would drown next to the dead girl who could be her twin. She hadn't seen the stranger approach, hadn't noticed her at all, until she spoke.
Cassiopeia?
She was extremely thin. Not the kind of Chloe DeWitt thinness that came from weight loss shakes and detox juices and SoulCycle, but true, not enough to eat, maybe dying of cancer thinness. It made her bones stand out in her cheeks, her knuckles huge and mannish, her knees like sharp kites angling for a wind. Her head was completely shaved. Above her right eyebrow was a long white scar, the width of a needle. The stranger took an uncertain step forward and nearly tripped over the girl lying dead in the mud, and she drew a sharp breath and stopped, holding herself very still. When she looked up at Gemma, her face had changed. Gemma had the impression of huge eyes sunk in that narrow face, and a question in them she didn't know how to answer. She took in the girl's clothing, a white t-shirt streaked with mud and grass, and what looked like bird shit, ugly cotton elastic waist pants, and then the girl's breasts, braless, hardly more than two sharp nipples beneath the fabric, her bare feet, the toenails colorless. Bare feet. Where had she come from with no shoes? But Gemma knew, even before she spotted the hospital bracelet, identical to the one secured around the dead girl's wrist. Oh my God! She felt as if her heart had been stilled with a hammer. She pictured it like an old-fashioned clock, splintered into uselessness. I think she's one of them. The Haven girl looked suddenly ferocious.
Who are you? She said. Where did you come from?
Who are you?
Jake's face was the bleached white of bone, but his voice was steady. Gemma wanted to reach out and take his hand, but her body wasn't obeying her correctly, and just then she was distracted by movement behind the girl, and something tall and dark and shadowed resolved itself into a boy.
Lyra, the girl said,
and when they said nothing, made an impatient gesture with one hand.
Number 24.
Oh my God,
Gemma said again. Her voice sounded high and shrill and unfamiliar, as if it were being piped through a tea kettle. Her mind kept reeling away from the dead girl lying not 4 feet away from her, the pattern of freckles on her face, the exact shape of her mouth, reeling away from the truth of it, like a magnet veering away from its pair.
There's another one.
She knew the boy must be from Haven, too, as soon as he appeared. He was barefoot and very thin, though not nearly so thin as the girl. Muscles showed through his t-shirt when he moved. He was mixed race and very beautiful, but there was something hard about him, too. He looked like one of the wax figurines in Madame Tussaud's, where she'd gone with her mom on a trip to New York ages ago. As if you could stare and stare into his eyes and get nothing back. A person, a little like a black hole. All the light vanished around him. She didn't see the knife in his hand until the boy stepped forward so that the light showed on its blade.
Look. Jake put up both hands as if he could physically stop the boy's progress. Hold on a second. Just hold on.
The boy gave no sign of having heard.
Who are you? He said, keeping the knife high.
Gemma realized in that second how stupid they'd been. How unprepared. They'd been scared of being arrested for trespassing. Not for a second had they considered that the Haven patients might be dangerous, maniacs, brain-altered killers. God only knew what kind of sick experiments they were doing there.
We're nobody, Jake said.
Very slowly he reached down and helped Gemma to her feet. Her body felt dull and even heavier than usual, as if it belonged to somebody else. Now, standing, she had a clearer view of the dead girl who looked like her. And it was terrible, worse than any nightmare, like staring into an open grave with a mirror at the bottom of it. She thought she might fall. She hardly trusted her legs to carry her. Jake was still talking, but she could barely understand him.
Listen, we're not going to hurt you, okay? My name's Jake Witz. This is Gemma. We got lost in the marshes, that's all.
The girl frowned and turned to Gemma. Gemma was glad for the excuse to look somewhere, anywhere, other than the body at her feet.
But who made you?
Gemma was sure she'd misheard.
What?
She whispered.
Who made you?
The girl repeated, more slowly this time, as if Gemma were very young or very stupid. The wind, which had filled the marshes with a kind of constant, sibilant hiss, an underlying rhythm, went still. Gemma could feel the pressure of a thousand invisible eyes peering at her from the mud, from their many hiding places.
I don't understand.
You're a replica, the girl said.
A what?
A replica, she repeated impatiently. An organism descended from or genetically identical to a single common ancestor. Gemma closed her eyes, hit with the sudden memory of being with her mom as a child at an art auction, bored out of her mind, listening to the auctioneer drone on and on about a vase that was supposedly the exact replica of the one in Versailles, where Louis XVII had occasionally stored his false teeth. Why, her mother had leaned down to whisper, would anyone spend so much money on a fake?
A clone, she said.
The word had a stupid sci-fi sound to it. She means a clone, Jake. Jake winced.
Yeah, well, I kind of already had that impression.
He kept his eyes on the boy with the knife. Gemma felt panic pressing on her from all sides, from inside, as if thousands of tiny fists were beating inside of her to get out. A clone. A replica. Why would anyone spend so much money on a fake? Gemma's thoughts were whirling like a hard snow, then disintegrating when she tried to catch hold of them. But it's impossible. She knew she was hysterical. She knew she was loud. But she didn't care and couldn't help it.
It's impossible. The technology doesn't exist. It's illegal.
It's not impossible, the Haven girl said. Gemma had the sudden vicious urge to punch her, to take her huge eyes out of their sockets, to get her to stop speaking, stop staring, stop.
At Haven, there were thousands of replicas.
Jesus, Jake whispered.
He closed his eyes for a second, and she saw that he looked almost restful, peaceful, as if they hadn't just stumbled on a girl with Gemma's exact face, her chest black with blood, as if they hadn't found two survivors of the place, looking scared but also dangerous like wild animals.
Clones. It all makes sense now.
Are you crazy? Nothing makes sense. Gemma's heart was twitching like a dying bug. There's a dead girl with my face on her. Jake turned to her, looking stricken, as if she'd reached out and slapped him. She wished she had. She had the urge to slap him, to shake the whole world and force it right again, like how her dad smacked the cable box whenever service was coming in weird. Thinking of her dad, of her home, suddenly made her feel very young and very afraid. She wished she'd listened to her parents. They'd been right all along. She should never have come. She wasn't strong enough. We're standing here in the middle of the fucking night and these people are telling me that there are clones running around out there, thousands of them.
Gemma, calm down.
Jake put a hand on her arm. She nearly screamed, but she was afraid to open her mouth again, afraid of losing it completely. Her father had known about Haven. All this time he'd known.
Everyone needs to calm down, okay?
Jake was saying. The boy with the knife had tensed up again.
Can you put that thing down, please? We're not going to hurt you.
The boy lowered the knife, finally. Jake had said the right thing, but Gemma didn't care. Even though they were standing in open air, she felt the sky might at any second collapse and bury them. She kneaded her chest with one hand, willing her heartbeat to slow down. The girl, she noticed, looked sick also. Somehow this made her feel less afraid. They couldn't be that dangerous, even if they did have a knife and looked like creepy escaped psych inmates from a horror film. And when the girl couldn't stand anymore, and instead crouched and ducked her head between her knees, breathing slowly, obviously trying to control her nausea, Jem felt sorry for her, and annoyed at the boy with the knife. He barely glanced at her. She took a deep breath. What's the matter with her? No one answered. Without really intending to, she moved slowly toward the girl. When the girl shuddered, her spine stood out, almost architectural beneath her shirt. And for the first time in her life, Gemma was actually happy she wasn't thin. She bent over. Her hand, as it floated toward the girl's shoulder, looked like a foreign object, a balloon or a spacecraft. Are you okay? For a millisecond, she was surprised by the feel of the girl's warmth, the tautness of her skin and the muscle beneath it. The girl looked so insubstantial, Gemma had almost expected a hand would pass through her. Then the girl jerked away, and Gemma took a quick step backward, her breath catching. The girl had looked at her with something close to hatred, and Gemma was again reminded of an animal. Once a few years ago, one of their handymen had cornered a rabid raccoon on the property, and her father had taken out his rifle to shoot it, and she'd never forgotten how its eyes looked, desperate and wild, before the bullet hit.
Maybe she's hungry, Jake said.
The girl said nothing. She wrapped her arms around her knees and dropped her head again, her spine rising and falling with every breath. But the boy took a step forward.
You have food?
His face was so full of open need that Gemma felt another lurch of pity. Had they been starved at Haven? Jake squatted to rifle through his backpack.
Sorry, he said, producing a few granola bars and two bottles of water. We didn't bring much.
The boy ate in a way that reminded Gemma of a squirrel, holding the granola bar with two hands and chewing quickly until it was all gone. He took water and drank half a bottle before passing it over to the girl, still crouching next to him. He said something too low for Gemma to hear, but the girl took the water from him and drank, and immediately she looked a little better. She would be very beautiful, Gemma thought, if she were heavier, if the lost, dark look of her eyes could somehow be warmed. Jake couldn't take his eyes off them, the boy and the girl, and Gemma could hardly stand to look at him. She guessed that, for him, this was the end of a long mystery, the final act. For her, this was the start. Her old world had exploded, and she'd been born again into a new one. All she wanted was to go back.
"Look," Jake said to them, "I know you must be tired. You've been through... I don't even know what you've been through."
Gemma thought she knew what he wanted, but hoped she was wrong. "Jake, no," she said warningly. She pressed a hand to her forehead, trying to push back the drumbeat of a migraine that was beating dully somewhere behind her eyes.
"They've been living in Haven, Gemma," Jake said quickly, as if she hadn't understood. "My father died for this. I need to know."
"Jake, no." The migraine exploded into existence. She imagined some sicko with a hammer pummeling her brain. "I don't believe you. I literally don't believe you. These poor people have been through God knows what. They're starving and cold and they have no place to go, and you want to interview them?"
"I don't want to interview them. I want to understand."
"Not people," the girl spoke up unexpectedly. Gemma turned to face her.
"What?"
she said. The girl was holding the water bottle tightly, her knuckles standing out, but she seemed calm. "We are not people," she said. Her voice had a low, musical quality, but it was strangely without effect, as if she hadn't been taught to feel, or at least to express herself. "You said, these poor people have been through God knows what, but we're replicas. God didn't make us. Dr. Saperstein did. He's our God." All of Gemma's anger evaporated in an instant. She was alone momentarily in the dark with this thin, frail girl, this clone who believed she was not a person. Gemma wanted to hug her. She wanted to understand, too, how she had become this way, how she had been made and why, who had taught her that God was out of reach. And she knew then that Jake was right, in a way. All the answers she needed, all the mysteries of her past, were bound up in the girl and boy from the island. She was still afraid of them, but also afraid for them in a way she couldn't verbalize. But she couldn't leave them alone. They had to stay close. "We should camp here for the night," she heard herself say, before she even knew that she was going to suggest it. Jake looked at her as if she'd lost her mind. Maybe she had. "We'll go back to Wally in the morning." The boy seemed uncertain. "We're not going anywhere with you."
"No," Gemma said evenly. "No, you don't have to go with us, not unless you want to."
Once again, Jake just stared at her, as if a hand had just emerged from her mouth and started waving.
"Why would we want to?" the boy asked.
Gemma ignored Jake, speaking directly to the boy.
"You can't plan on staying here forever. You have no money, no ID. You're not even supposed to exist. And there will be people looking for you."
She would have known this even if she hadn't seen, earlier that night, the helicopters pass overhead for hours, even if she hadn't seen soldiers outfitted in riot gear patrolling the coast. If the girl was telling the truth, and Gemma had proof that she was, in the form of the corpse she could hardly stand to look at, and Haven had indeed been full of clones, there had to be a reason for all the secrecy, the protections, the confidentiality. It should have been a miracle from modern science. The scientists who'd perfected the process should have won Nobel Prizes. Everyone in the world should have known about it. And yet nobody did. The question was, why? She knew that whoever was in charge wouldn't allow the products of his or her experiments to run free, not when those products could talk and think for themselves. She assumed the only reason that the girl and boy, the replicas, hadn't been found and taken into custody already was because of all the chaos. Probably they were still counting the dead and the missing. Staying on the marshes for any length of time was a huge risk. But Gemma sensed that the clones weren't ready to move yet, and she knew that she had to stay close to them, that the ember of truth was here with them. She needed time to think and to plan. She expected more resistance from Jake, but he only shook his head and said, "We should try and get some sleep. We'll want to get off the marshes as soon as possible." And the clones didn't argue anymore. They obviously didn't want to be too far from the food and water. They moved to the far side of a contorted thicket of mangrove trees that blocked them from a view of the body. Gemma didn't want to camp so close to the dead girl. She couldn't stand to think of her. That face, like her face, hollowed out by hunger. The hair that Gemma sweated and toiled to keep straight, shaved close to her fragile scalp. She had never been superstitious, but it felt like a bad omen, as if the fate of her double might wear off on her. On the other hand, she didn't want to go far in the darkness, and the girl and the boy, the replicas, were exhausted. The replicas bedded down side by side, although Gemma noticed that they hardly spoke or even acknowledged each other, as if they each belonged to two separate realities that only coexisted momentarily. Jake fell asleep right away, using a rolled-up towel as a pillow, and clutching his backpack as though it were a teddy bear. Gemma, however, lay awake long after even the replicas had fallen asleep. It wasn't just because she was physically uncomfortable. She was clammy and too hot. The whine of mosquitoes needled her. The ground was uneven and unpleasantly spongy. She was dirty, and she was sure that she smelled. But because of an itchy, hard-to-name feeling inside, like the wriggling of thousands of ants under her skin, in her blood and her veins. She imagined the girl on the other side of the trees, the second Gemma, coming to life again, slithering through the mud, reaching for Gemma's face with bloodied fingernails, reaching for Gemma's hair, demanding it back. She had to sit up, stifling a cry of terror. Someone had cloned her. It was the only explanation that made sense, but she couldn't accept it. Had her father known? Was that why he had left Fine and Ives and ruptured forever with his business partner? Was that why he'd wanted Haven shut down? A scientist had taken a sample of Gemma's DNA when she was a baby and used it to make another Gemma. Except, the dead girl wasn't just another Gemma. She had Gemma's DNA, her face, and her freckles. But even now, her insides were liquefying, her stomach bloating with gases. She'd had a different name, different memories and preferences, and a very different life. Two people built of the same material, but radically separated by experience, and now by death. Had her father known? Or had he only suspected? Maybe during one of her many hospital stays as a baby, someone had stolen some tissue from her without her parents' knowledge. That must be it. There would have been a black market for things like this, places on the internet you could go to buy kitty porn and new livers and medical samples. She knew that was nonsensical, though. What were the chances that her DNA had randomly ended up in the same research institute her father's company had helped fund? She would never sleep. How could she, with that dead girl, that doubled girl, so close by? So many thoughts were turning in her head, she felt dizzy. She had to know. She had to understand this place and what her father's connection to it had been. What her connection to it was. It was much harder to get into the kayak without Jake there to steady her, and again, she had a fear of turning over and getting stuck, like a banana in a too-tight skin. But she managed it eventually and, after flailing around with the paddle for a bit, loosed herself from the tangle of long grass and reeds and maneuvered into the dark, glassy water. She didn't even know how to read a compass, even though her phone must have had one. But she felt confident that she was sufficiently close to the island that she wouldn't get lost, and she even had the idea of tying her sweatshirt to the overhanging branches of one of the mangrove trees so that she would be able to find her way back. After only a few minutes, she regretted the decision. Paddling was much harder than Jake had made it look.